Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another Bite Mark special episode. And joining me today is a very special guest. Say hello to Miskatonic Fox, or just Fox. Say hi.
Hello, everyone.
Why don't you introduce yourselves to the audience, Fox?
My name is Kay, or as you can call me, Fox, and I've been a fan of the Metal Gear Solid series for a while, which is going to be our subject today. I'm from Utah, and I'm a leftist. I'm not sure I'd consider myself an anarchist at this point, but I'm generally libertarian, and we're here to discuss contradictions within the Metal Gear Solid universe.
Yes, the theme for today's episode can be broadly summarized as Metal Gear Solid, a series of contradictions. Let me lay my cards out here on the table. I don't have a lot of experience firsthand playing many of the Metal Gear games, which is why I've brought you on, Fox, because I find them very fascinating as a piece of media, but some of the games are very obtuse to get into and so on and so forth. And so I would like to use your experience and many, many years playing the games as a lens to explore this. And why did we pick contradictions? Well, Hideo Kojima is an interesting man.
Yes, he is.
You guys will see throughout the course of this episode, basically, it's a very complicated topic. Why don't you kick us off with the first contradiction?
All right. Well, probably one of the largest in general to discuss is Kojima is very much an anti-war individual. War is a major topic within the Metal Gear Solid universe, as is peace, nuclear proliferation, and arms manufacturing and trade. And in general, he does have a stance that he would prefer to find peaceful methods, I believe. He seemed to sympathize with the non-aligned movement, but at the same time has something of a fascination and worship of the art of war, soldiers, and even the weapons of war. He views them as one of the highest expressions of manliness, oddly enough, throughout his series, it seems.
That's going to come up later, actually.
Yes, we will talk about that as well. But in general, the idea of being a soldier for peace and what that entails, how you can take such a stance and yet continue to fight and struggle for ideas you believe in or ideas you claim you don't hold, which is another part of that contradiction.
How exactly would you say that Kojima thinks about war in terms of, let's start it off with mechanically. So are there resonant themes? I know he makes, basically most of the Metal Gears are espionage-style games. They're not out-and-out like first-person shooters. Why do you think that is?
Yeah. Well, he likes to express his themes through gameplay, and typically you play the games stealthily. That is both, you know, the intent of the game and also part of his message, you know, using subterfuge and cleverness as a way to avoid conflict. The game will even sometimes punish you. There's a character in Metal Gear Solid 3. The more soldiers you kill, the longer you have to wade through his river of death.
Every time I read about Kojima, it seems to me that he is very much interested in games as a replacement, for movies. And I find that to be really interesting, because a lot of what I see about Metal Gear makes it seem as if Kojima really, really wants to make a movie about, you know, the Cold War, about espionage, about stuff like that, but he can't do that, and so he makes this game. Do you think that's accurate?
Yes, I would. He wanted to be a filmmaker from a fairly young age. He started off writing, sending in 400-page-long short stories that were all rejected because they were too long for short stories. And then he started making 8mm films, and he was very much a latchkey kid. His father wasn't around. His father died at a young age, and that's important to another topic we'll discuss as well. Yeah, he watched a lot of movies.
I remember when I was doing some of the research, if I'm not mistaken, Kojima's father died when he was about 13, which is a very young age, you know, to lose a parent. And you know, he took that loss quite seriously. I also know that you know, he was always trying to be a creative, but I think Japan at that time wasn't really exactly the most receptive place for the kind of creativity that I think Kojima was trying to bring out. And maybe that's why he latched on to movies.
That's a part, that definitely is a part of it, and it was, even today, in Japan's societal norms, it's typically viewed as kind of pointless to go into the arts. It's not that they don't have a respect for it, but at the same time, they don't consider it a stable job, which is something that you're supposed to seek, you know, a safe job that you can use to continue your family life.
Yeah, I did an episode a while back talking about South Korea and Parasite, and that seems to be very much a general theme of these hyper-capitalist Asian societies that are struggling with, you know, the system of capitalism. But we are getting a little bit off topic. Let's bring it back to Metal Gear. So, how would you say? Well, let's deal with the elephant in the room. What exactly is a Metal Gear?
Metal Gear is essentially a vertical tank or mech, you could just call it a mech, that was originally designed in order to replace the intercontinental ballistic missile, essentially a weapon system that could send nuclear missiles anywhere.
And you know, I've always been fascinated by mechs, but the Metal Gears aren't really, they're not very traditional to, you know, Japanese or Asian styles of sort of, you know, mech design. It's not as if a Metal Gear is mostly a humanoid, you know, figure that's commanded by like a guy who's, you know, in the vein of like something like what's it? Gundam. No, the Metal Gears are very almost unnatural, almost alien in a way. I've seen some of their designs. They look very unusual.
Yeah. Their designs are kind of odd, but when I use the term vertical tank or walking tank, that's a term they use in the game itself, and that's kind of what I think informed their design, because they have a very militaristic design to them that you don't see as much in other mechs, although there are some exceptions, like the ones in Metal Gear Solid 2 and then Metal Gear Solid 5. The Sylanthropus is very kind of like a traditional mech, like a humanoid body. And the one in Metal Gear Solid 2 is much more alien and strange.
Are
They even kind of seem to have a bioorganic sense, anyway.
the mechs a metaphor for maybe nuclear annihilation? Or is that a little bit,
Yes. That is more or less what they could be brought down to. Throughout the series, he up the topic of nuclear proliferation. That's a major theme in Metal Gear 2 and the original Metal Gear Solid in particular, but in Metal Gear Solid, to use that example, they talk about how the Cold War, you know, didn't really end with the falling of the Soviet Union, that it just sort of went underground, and they were trying to find a way to clandestinely create a new Metal Gear, to essentially sell it on a black market.
Yeah, you know, I think Japan is one of the places where uniquely, having been the only country in the world to ever been nuked in war, they've always developed I think something of a fear fascination with you know, nuclear weapons and nuclear annihilation. I think it's really interesting then that the stand-in for nuclear annihilation is, you know, a mech. Because in one way, you know, to talk about a contradiction, in one way, a mech is generally speaking something that the average soldier with a rifle is really not going to be able to deal with. But on the other hand, the mech is a personable enemy, right? You can face it, you can fight it, you can defeat it. You can't really defeat a nuclear bomb, you know, once it's detonated. And I find that to be really interesting.
Yeah, they seem to personify it in a sense, which is actually common in a lot of media that represents the nuclear bomb. I mean, Godzilla originally was like that. They tend to personify it in some way.
And you know, one of the things that, you know, you have to talk about is that if you are going to personify the enemy, then maybe you can, you know, defeat the enemy. But that's not really a theme of Metal Gear, is it? It seems like with with all of the games that get made, and there are very many games, it seems like you can never really get rid of the threat of Metal Gear. Would you say that's correct?
Yes, although that does sort of change by the end of Metal Gear Solid 4, which, more or less signifies the end of war. But one of the things with Metal Gear, and speaking of contradictions, is in regards to Big Boss and his philosophy, the idea of creating a homeland for soldiers that has no loyalty to any nation. And that's when he started creating the Metal Gear that's used in the original Metal Gear. Well, it
So,
was.
who is Big Boss?
Big Boss is, in the universe of Metal Gear Solid, is a legendary soldier. His original. I actually can't remember his original name. I had it written down earlier. But his original name doesn't necessarily matter. His exploits are shown throughout the series. Originally, he was just a villain in Metal Gear 1 and Metal Gear 2, but they later expanded more upon that, particularly in Metal Gear Solid 3, which was a prequel that told his story, how he was an elite US operative, and eventually he was betrayed by his country and somebody that he loved dearly and who more or less taught him everything was also betrayed by the US. And he becomes sort of an individualist who tries to live out the will of the boss, who was the woman who trained him, and together they created close quarters combat. That's actually canon. They're the ones who invented that.
That's actually pretty funny.
Yeah.
It's interesting that you mentioned that he's a soldier. It's fascinating to me that Hideo Kojima tries to make, like, okay, so here's the thing about making an anti-war game. Like, there's a game like Spec Ops: The Line, which is a game that is anti-war, but it's anti-war in the way that it's going to force you to commit a war crime against civilians, and then it's going to shame you for doing that. And the whole point is really that you shouldn't be playing this game, really.
Yeah,
But
it was also kind of a satire of other shooters at the time.
exactly. It's making fun of the shooter genre, right? But at times, it's very difficult to tell whether or not Metal Gear Solid takes itself seriously or whether or not it's trying to satirize spy movies, action movies. That's a contradiction that I just find so fascinating. It's like, I've seen a lot of memes about Metal Gear Solid, and it's like, on the one hand, Hideo Kojima, there's that common one that pops up. It's like, there's a part in the game, in one of the games, where you can shoot a cup and then ice will fall out, and there's an algorithm that they had to put in the game to calculate the melting of the ice. And I was like, what is going on here? What Kojima, what are you doing? But yeah, could you just elucidate that for me, please? Because I'm struggling.
I'm sorry, briefly elucidate
Yeah, look,
on what aspect? The soldiers?
no, it's like, why do you think, let me put it bluntly, do you think that the tone of Metal Gear Solid is consistent? Do you think that for the most part Kojima is trying
No,
to do
the tone,
satire, or is he all over the place?
he's all over the place.
Aha.
And that's something that's become more apparent as I look back at the series. His tone changes with his own kind of personal whim, you can tell. And the series gets darker as it goes along, but it doesn't always earn that darkness, especially in Metal Gear Solid 5. The earlier games kind of felt like they had a bit of an anime tone. Like, if you could imagine an anime pastiche of American action movies and military movies, that's how I would describe the kind of tone of earlier Metal Gear Solid. And then around Peace Walker 4 and then 5, that tone began to slip. And even beforehand, I feel that it had some strange moments, like torture being a mechanic that if you don't suffer enough, it changes the ending of Metal Gear Solid 1.
What? That's crazy. Oh my
Yeah, if you
goodness.
don't succeed at button mashing, because there's a torture segment where you just have to keep button mashing until you get carpal tunnel.
Oh my goodness. But you see, this is why I think contradiction is the best way to describe it, because I think for some sense, Kojima is one of the few auteur game creators, right? Now, I know that he doesn't make the games himself. It's literally impossible to make the games at this kind of scale and complexity with one person. But he is a figure in the gaming industry that has a huge amount of personal involvement and personal direction in terms of the games that he makes. It's actually kind of a meme that you can look at a game and go, that is a Kojima, brand game. And I find it
Yes.
interesting that he's all over the place, that he's in contradiction with himself, that he has these ideas and then he does these things. Like, for example, button mashing is a great example. If you're trying to do a torture scene, what you don't want to do is take the player out of the scene by forcing them to mash buttons on a controller.
Yeah. And that's a recurring thing in the series, actually. There's a torture scene in Metal Gear Solid 1, Metal Gear Solid 2, Metal Gear Solid 3. Although he also has a bad habit of being repetitive. This is another meme I'm sure you've seen people play on, particularly in dialogue, where discussions with Solid Snake, it's like, the people will be giving this exposition, and they'll say, we have this Metal Gear, and it's going to, attack a town. Metal Gear, huh?
I've seen a couple of those. Solid
Yeah.
Snake has the conversational gumption of a let's say a chewed up piece of gum stuck on the underside of a table. He'll stick with you, but it's not going to be the most pleasant experience.
Yeah, and like I said, he just has a habit of sort of reinforcing points. Just say something, that somebody else said right after they say
Again, we have to keep coming back to this because it's impossible not to.
it.
Do you think that he does this just because he wants to make movies, but he can't? And so his games are essentially an inner expression of his desire to make movies, and they play very much like many movies tend to do, especially older, like back in the day, the heyday of the action genre. A lot of the dialogue in those movies was terrible.
Yeah. I do think that he genuinely does enjoy making games as well, but he definitely wishes he were making movies. That's definitely something he aspires to much more. But he's, to be honest, in my opinion, he's much more at home at designing the games. He's better as a game designer, in my opinion.
I think that's really interesting because, on the one hand, a lot of things that I see in the Metal Gear series looks kind of ridiculous and silly. But on the other hand, I see some examples of very compelling, very interesting game design, very, meaningful moments where two characters will have an emotional revelation and, they will seriously talk about a thing, that doesn't get talked about. Like, say, for example, Metal Gear is one of the few franchises that I know of that actually favorably gives a light to someone like Che Guevara, right? That's not something that happens in video games. It's just it's a mishmash of different ideas, and it comes across sometimes confusing, but sometimes also very sincere and earnest. Like Kojima wants to
Yes.
tell you something personally, and he's going to do it.
That's definitely what I believe he's trying to do, and he tries to communicate those themes through his gameplay sometimes. Sometimes he does it well, others not so much. And I bring up the whole torture thing. Another example of him kind of putting that into the game, but maybe stumbling a little, is with Metal Gear Solid 5. With the character of Big Boss, they tried to make him, a fully fleshed character through the prequels, but the question was, when does he become a villain? And Metal Gear Solid 5 tried to, do that a little bit, get to that point with the twist that you were playing as a clone of him, as, Venom's Snake, who eventually was meant to be an avatar for the character. He was just some random medic who got chosen to essentially become, emulate Big Boss. He believed he was Big Boss. That was his entire purpose. And in the game, you can buy steal nuclear weapons and sell them as well. And the more nuclear weapons you get, the more nuclear weapons you sell, you'll start to grow horns. It will explicitly call your character evil. Like, you know, he will become more demonic looking. I think even at some point he even gets covered in blood if you start selling the nukes.
That's really interesting. And that is, we are going to cover that a bit later, but I wanted to circle back to something that, you know, I think is also important to talk about, you know, and that is Kojima and patriarchy. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if there is a feminist reading of Metal Gear Solid that is really complete, because the entire series is fairly expansive and, of course, you know, not exactly an entirely coherent piece of work. But I would like, you know, you to run me down some of what is the contradiction at heart, you know, in terms of Kojima and patriarchy. What is at play here?
Well, if we're using the term patriarchy in, you know, feminist terms, the issue there, I don't know if he really knows that much about feminism. Mm. It's not as big a thing in Japan. I mean, there are Japanese feminists. There absolutely are. But he's never really expressed much of an interest in that. And his female characters are interesting because in some ways you could almost make them interchangeable with the males. They are equal on a lot of levels, and a lot of them are very talented soldiers, some of them legends in their own right. But
the boss, right?
They're often... Yeah, the boss is an example. Well, you know, even Meryl, Sniper Wolf, the Beauty and Beast Corps, Fortune from Metal Gear Solid 2. There's a lot of examples there. But at the same time, he definitely does sexualize them, and he tends to code them in ways that kind of represent traditional gender values. And he does the same for men as well.
One of the reasons why I bring this up is, of course, the elephant in the room, or the scantily clad elephant in the room, and that is Quiet from Metal Gear Solid 5. I don't know, I didn't know much about Metal Gear, but even I know that her design, for the viewers at home, Quiet is a woman, a sniper, a soldier, but she wears basically no clothing except for like fishnets and a bikini. And the game gives you a reason for why that is, a really rubbish reason, which involves that she has to breathe through her skin.
Yes, she breathes through her skin. She also barely talks throughout the whole thing, and the reason for that is a little flimsy too. I mean, they tie it into the fact that she was tested on using a parasite that the villain Skullface wanted to use to essentially erase the English language.
Oh my goodness.
Metal Gear Solid 5's story is not Kojima's best. And, I mean, Quiet is the most infamous example, but that's not the first time he's done something like that. I mean, I haven't played Peace Walker, but when I was doing some research on Peace Walker, the character Paz, who I was aware of because she's in Metal Gear Solid 5, and we'll bring her up as well, but she literally pilots the Metal Gear in Peace Walker in a bikini the whole time. And it's also especially weird because you're initially led to believe she's a minor.
Oh my gosh.
She's not, but...
That's weird, right? That's very weird.
It is. It is. It certainly is.
Okay. And... I have to ask, because this is, I think, another important contradiction, you know, if we're going to be talking about contradictions, and that is Kojima has this idea of presenting women, you know, like you said, in a fairly progressive way, you know, the idea of boss as a character is really progressive, right? Powerful female military soldier who has her own agency, her own ideas, and ultimately, you know, sets up in motion, you know, consequences for the world that, you know, a man is typically responsible for doing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I looked up her character design, and I think she's got, like, why is her shirt unbuttoned?
A little bit of sexualization again, plus they also, she has a scar on her chest. that is actually... They try to justify it in the sense that, you know, she wants that scar on to display to show her pain to the world, because she gave birth to a character who we later find out is Ocelot, literally on D-Day, on the battlefield, and it was, you know, their child was taken from her, and she has a snake-shaped scar to kind of remind the world of that.
Yeah, you know, if people aren't already confused about Kojima, I'm not sure if we're going to really clear it up here. But, you know, the thing is, what is, you know, contradictory? And I have some ideas about why that is. On the one hand, you know, we talk that Kojima is heavily influenced by film. The films that he's most influenced by are not exactly great representations for women. You know, action movies back in the day, women had minor roles. They were sexualized. They were really trivialized in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You know? And I have to wonder if Kojima's attitudes towards women, he feels this desire to include them, right? Because I think he wants to tell a story that's different. He wants to tell, you know, an authentic story. But on the other hand, I don't know if he can necessarily escape from, you know, maybe like the atmospheric social norms of, you know, the time and himself and Japan. I don't know, you know, if that's necessarily the case, that he's trying to do this, but on the other hand, he maybe just can't help himself. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I would say that's very accurate. That seems to be very much what he's trying to do, and he seems very bound, in a way, by those traditional gender roles, even if he wants to buck the trend to some degree. I mean, he even wants to buck it with the men to some extent as well, since he loves, you know, it is encouraged not to be violent, you know, not to solve your problems with violence. That's wrong. Big Boss is condemned for that. And I even mentioned the character of Liquid Snake, who is very toxic masculine from the very moment you meet him, in both in Metal Gear Solid 1 and in Metal Gear Solid 5, when you meet him as a child, as he wants to be a warlord as well. And you frequently have conflict with him as Big Boss.
Why don't you tell us about Liquid Snake and toxic masculinity exactly? Because I don't know anything about Liquid Snake.
Well, Liquid Snake is a clone of Big Boss, much the same way that Solid Snake and Solidus Snake are. But I know the names.
Is there a plasma snake and a gas snake?
No, they're not. You know of all the snakes except Naked Snake and Venom Snake, who are technically just different names for Big Boss and the body double of Big Boss, respectively.
We are going to talk a little bit about Death Stranding later, but I just have to say Kojima and his name conventions are wild.
Yes.
All right,
anyway, Liquid Snake, when you're introduced to him, you know, he's right off the bat talking about the legacy of Big Boss and a desire to live up to it. He wants to be a legendary soldier, much like Big Boss was. It's a big status thing for him, and he's consumed by that much more than anything else he's doing. He could care less about war or, you know, where the Metal Gear is ultimately going to go, who it's going to be sold to. But he wants that status, and he sees himself as needing to do it because he believes that he has the recessive traits of Big Boss. That turns out not to be the case. Solid is the one who received the recessive traits and is therefore the quote-unquote inferior clone. However, his obsession with that is he has to become the superior. He has to prove that he's not a runt. And that also, in a lot of ways, is kind of his undoing in the end. They bring up the whole thing about genes don't make who you are in that game. They contradict that in places later on as well. But despite Solid being in technically the actual inferior one, he wins out when Liquid Snake dies of a disease known as Fox Dye, which was intentionally meant to eventually cull the clones.
Oh my goodness. Oh boy. this is really interesting. I remember reading in your notes that Metal Gear Solid 4 and 5 are very turbulent, and I'm starting to see why that is.
Mm-hmm. Well, Metal Gear Solid 4, when I mentioned he was a bit all over the place, he puts so much of himself in his games that you can even tell what mood he is in at a time. And Metal Gear Solid 4 is probably the most infamous example because he did not want to make that game at all. He wanted to make anything but another Metal Gear Solid, and he more or less just made that out of obligation because there was nothing else, you know, he really could make. Konami wasn't really interested in anything else that he was proposing. And Metal Gear Solid 4 is, as I mentioned earlier, when the series tried to get a little darker, a little meaner, and a little more cynical at times, in spite of a kind of hopeful ending. But I think that has more to do with the fact that he started to make peace with some of his own views, as well as some of his father's views. Because he puts the topic of family into his games a lot.
Yeah, I noticed there's quite a lot. There's Paz, obviously. You said you talk a little bit about her. But then there's also the B-Squad. I think they're also, a weird kind of... Well, actually, why don't you get into it? Because I'd be interested to hear your thoughts.
The Beauty and Beast Squad were, in each kind of Metal Gear game, there's always some special force group that you have to contend with throughout the game. And they're that, for Metal Gear Solid 4. And each of them are women who have a military background of some kind, that or they were affected by war and imperialism, either or. And they're essentially trapped in these machine-esque bodies that are literally draw power from their PTSD.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And each of them has some traumatic background that is what gave them their emotion. Like, there's Laughing Octopus, who was forced to torture several people she knew, and learned that it was supposedly a funny thing. The people that would torture and force her to torture would laugh, and so she started laughing, that sort of thing. That's the general kind of theme they do of them, is they're all bound by their emotion and their trauma. And as far as what they did with Paz in Metal Gear Solid 5, this was also kind of infamous, but she was,
yeah, I was reading about it. It's messed up.
Yeah, she was captured by Skullface and Cypher, who are more or less... I mean, Cypher is just another term for the Patriots, who are more or less the main villains of the series. But, anyway, she was forcefully raped by...
Content warning. Content warning.
Yeah, sorry. She was raped by Chico, and Chico was a child soldier in Big Boss's army, and, he was forced to do it. He did not want to do it, and it traumatized him as well. And then, while on the plane, you find out she had a bomb in her stomach, and you have to perform surgery, unanesthetized, to remove the bomb. And then it turns out there was another bomb implanted in, I believe they said, her womb or her cervix, one of the two, that they weren't able to remove, so she jumps out of the plane and sacrifices herself.
That's horrific. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, that is how extreme they went in terms of dark content in the later games. And there was dark and serious stuff in them before. I mean, you're still dealing with nuclear war, the concept of, child soldiers was introduced early on, but they never really went that far.
Yeah, that sounds like, that's like darkness and edginess for the sake of edginess. You're not really. I mean, damn, that is really messed up. And I'm not sure if it's necessarily the best idea to have a female character whose life is this messed up, and then she just dies in a very horrific way. I guess it's character development, and going back to that idea that back in the day, women were really just sacrificial lambs for character development of men, and that really kind of reads a lot like that.
Yeah, well, that's another thing is a lot of the women get sacrificed. Almost, it's a recurring theme that they either do or that they are defined in some way by a trauma in their past. I mean, that's true of Meryl, that's true of Sniper Wolf. I mean, Meryl does have more character than that. That shouldn't be, that's a little unfair, but I think you kind of know what I mean. They have that scene where.
I have to wonder if perhaps maybe some of this is maybe the fact that Kojima was raised by, his dad died when he was young. He was raised by his mother. From what I've read, they weren't too well off, growing up.
No.
So I don't know to what degree, that kind of situation would really give its own, kind of traumas and social conditioning to a kid. Yeah, it's kind of messed
Well,
up.
it very much did affect him. I mean, when with his father reflects some of the ideas explored in Metal Gear Solid because his father wanted to join the Navy, and even when he was younger, he'd climb to the rooftops to watch the bombs fall on Tokyo during the air raids, and he had a huge admiration and love of soldiers, but was disgusted by war. And I kind of even have this direct thing here where Kojima's talking about as a child, he made Kojima watch an anti-war film, Night and Fog. This isn't the kind of movie a child can understand, says Hideo Kojima. There was this other movie, but I can't remember the name of it. America and Germany are fighting, and they run out of resources, and their casualties are melting. It gets to the point where they're no longer able to continue fighting, so they agree to a ceasefire for a day. As a child, I couldn't understand this. If they can sit down and talk like that, why do they even need to fight in the first place, I thought. That's kind of what he was thinking when he was young. That's kind of how he was raised, and to see the world. And you can see that reflected because he loves the idea of a soldier, of somebody who is willing to use their strength to fight for something they believe in and protect their people. He is very much in love in that idea, but he hates nations, he hates the men who send soldiers to war, so on and so forth.
That is actually the perfect segue into the last major contradiction, and that is Metal Gear Solid as anti-war war games. So, I think there's always a contradiction in a video game where you have an idea of the game. I think the term is ludonarrative dissonance, to put on my fancy game critic hat, where you
Yes.
have a theme of the game that is contrary to, the mechanical reality of the game. My preferred example is Darkest Dungeon, one of my favorite games. One
It's a
of those
great game.
themes, it's a great game. One of those themes is that you have to not treat the people that you send into the dungeons as people. You have to dehumanize them and treat them as meat. Otherwise, you are not going to be able to sustain the war against, the evil. However, Darkest Dungeon, allows you to, if you feel for those people, you will have a bad time playing the game. And if you don't feel, then you'll have a ludonarrative dissonance. But if you don't feel anything for them, then you will just be able to send them into the grinder time after time. And with Metal Gear Solid, you've got a game about soldiers, you've got a game about armies, and perhaps most importantly, the question of whether or not war is, and you can speak to this, but whether or not war is some kind of an inherent thing in humanity, that we always need soldiers, that we need war, but we want peace, but we can't disentangle ourselves from this contradiction. Would you say that's correct?
Yeah, I would say that is correct. He tries to solve that a little bit in Metal Gear Solid 4, because with the character of Big Boss, you get the twist that Big Boss was still alive. I'm not sure how he survived being more or less immolated in Metal Gear 2.
But it doesn't matter.
It's nanomachines. Nanomachines are magic in Metal Gear Solid. Much. That's basically all you need to know. But, you know, there's a quote that Big Boss has at the end of Metal Gear Solid 4, where he's at the boss's grave, and he's kind of looking back at all that he's done and realized that he's made a lot of mistakes, but that at the same time, you know, Solid has actually changed the world for the better. But anyway, the quote is, "It's not about the changing the world. It's about doing our best to leave the world the way it is. It's about respecting the will of others and believing in your own. Isn't that what you fought for?" And in a sense, yeah, that is what the boss fought for, is because she wanted to see a world where there were no arbitrary divisions between anyone, be it nation, you know, politics, anything like that. But at the same time, he came to the conclusion that there was always going to be war. I mean, his character also became addicted to war. He said that he liked the war, and even, you know, Solid Snake has to deal with that after Metal Gear Solid 1. He finds out that he enjoys fighting for something, but he doesn't take the path that Big Boss took, which was to essentially create a state of soldiers that would live on their own and, you know, not really answer to any nation, but go where they felt they were needed. And it tries to, you know, solve some of the issues there, but it still ultimately puts the fate of the world at the hands of someone who would probably still have to fight. The war isn't really over at the end just because they finally solve the issue of Metal Gears and get rid of the philosophers. There's still nations to contend with. There's still all of that, really.
So the way that I think of Metal Gear Solid, and the way that I think has become a little bit more clear when we have this conversation, is the entire series is Kojima having a conversation with himself about how he feels about war and whether or not you can really disentangle all of the positive things that he thinks and associates with war, like self-sacrifice, you know, the nobility of the soldier, and all of that, with the actual reality of the war, that it causes tremendous suffering, that people die, that it's pointless and destructive, right? That it creates divisions.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't feel as if he has an answer to this question, because it feels as if, you know, at least by the time of Metal Gear Solid 5, the characters that he's developed, the characters that we have shown, you know, in the series, are increasingly turning to measures that in earlier games, you know, like you said, you can sell nukes, and yeah, sure, the game will, you know, chastise you for it, but it still allows you to sell nukes. You know, it's how do you feel about that?
Well, in Metal Gear Solid 5, what he was kind of trying to do there is, again, with the character of Venom Snake, he was just some medic who was more or less given the face of Big Boss and the task to basically become Big Boss. And he was kind of, Kojima was kind of using that as a little bit of a fourth wall break to try and kind of put it in the hands of the player to really illustrate, you know, these are your choices, and it's also up to you to decide whether or not you will live up to the ideals of this character, because you are playing somebody who is meant to emulate Big Boss. But I don't know if it does a particularly good job of really figuring out what you're really supposed to be as quote-unquote Big Boss. You're imitating a character, and you know what he's going to do, because at least if you're following the story, which by this point you should, or else you're not going to have any goddamn clue what's going on. Five is especially hoary with its lore, but in general, it doesn't really communicate a particularly solid message to the player. In fact, he kind of lost his ability to really send those messages with Metal Gear Solid 4 and 5, because they became a lot more confused and muddled, I feel. He was able to do it a little easier in the earlier games, because I can tell you the message of Metal Gear Solid 2, I can tell you the one of Metal Gear Solid 1, but not as much the later games.
I have to wonder if perhaps maybe this is a product of maybe Kojima's, Kojima's own inability to answer the question, you know, like, how is it possible to build an army of peace, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How is it possible to build an army of peace? How is it possible to transition, you know, you brought up, you know, a quote earlier from the boss, where she talks about wanting a world where capitalism and communism don't exist, right? Where we have transcended these divisions. Now, I find this particularly, you know, to be interesting, because at the time of the game, right, but also, you know, largely of the time of the game's creation, we were dealing with the specter of the Cold War, right? And the communism that Boss is referring to is not communism as we might imagine it or want it today. It is a Soviet style of communism, a very authoritarian style of communism. And I have to wonder, you know, if we are basically just replaying a lot of Francis Fukuyama, who I've brought up many times on my channel, in that we are struggling to imagine a world. I think maybe Kojima as well is struggling to imagine a world beyond the dichotomy that we had. Like, it's very easy in the Cold War to imagine, oh, there's capitalism, there's communism. You know, several characters talk about communism as if it is a more favorable thing. You know, brings up Che Guevara as a revolutionary, you know, fighting for freedom. But then as we develop into this new, arguably very cursed decade and, you know, really century, we see that actually there haven't really been any alternatives to capitalism. You know, after the fall of the Soviet Union, very little was actually able to be done in terms of building an alternative. And I have to wonder if you're someone who thinks, okay, you know, the Cold War is going to end, there has to be something, you know, else after this. We can't just be, you know, doing this whole thing. And then you see how things progress as Kojima has done. You know, it almost in a way, you know, maybe forces you to lose a little bit of hope. And maybe that's why the later games are a little bit less coherent, because Kojima is looking for an answer that doesn't exist, you know?
Yeah. Well, that's something that a lot of the people in the games in general were struggling as well in the narrative. They were different interpretations of how to achieve that world. Big Boss wanted to... He took, I guess, what you could call more of an anarchist approach. If I were to compare him to anyone, it would be more anarcho-capitalist. They even use the black and yellow color scheme. But at the same time, Big Boss's ideology is contradictory. He claims that he doesn't have one. There's a quote at the end of Peace Walker, I believe, that I heard while researching on that one a little bit. But, you know, we will forsake our countries, we will leave our motherlands behind us and become one with the earth. We have no nation, no philosophy, no ideology. We go where we're needed, fighting not for country, but for ourselves. And, but that in itself is still kind of a philosophy. Yeah, he has an ideology.
Yeah,
he just doesn't seem to realize it.
It's as a noted trash raccoon and internet celebrity Slavoj Žižek says, everything is ideology.
It is pure ideology.
Oh man, I kind of want in Kojima's next game, I kind of want him to meet like a guy who's just called Hot Dog Man, and it's just Slavoj Žižek. And you meet him, he's just eating a hot dog, and then you talk to him, and he'll just give you like a 3-hour long, you know,
yes,
discourse.
The Pervert's Guide to Metal Gear Solid 5.
I would love that, honestly.
I would enjoy it too.
If this podcast does get big enough, you know, hopefully one day, I will send an email to Slavoj Žižek and ask him if he wants to come on.
That'd be fun. I can also tell you my friend Dan is a fan of Slavoj.
I'm a big fan of Slavoj. I have I want to get into reading some of his books. I've seen a lot of his essays. He demolished Peterson. He did honestly a public service by smacking him down, you know, like that. He didn't recover really.
No.
And then the IDW basically kind of gave up the jig because, you know, they couldn't. But anyway, we're getting.
But
we're
so
getting
to get back a little on topic, you know, and Big Boss was largely opposed by the Patriots, the remains of the philosophers who were originally created, actually to stop war. They were created after World War One, as sort of a unified power between the kind of newborn Soviet Union, America, and China, to try and prevent anything like the Great War ever happening again. So they put away a lot of money that would hopefully fund something that could stop that if it were the case. But later on, the people who replaced the original philosophers, the Patriots, they had different factions. Big Boss split off, and then there was Major Zero, who saw basically total control of the world. That would be the way to demolish the boundaries. You know, essentially a one-world state, and then later on, the AI that later even begins to take over the Patriots turns it into a permanent war economy, which fulfills Big Boss's dream of soldiers having a purpose, but they're still, in a sense, being exploited, since the wars in the war economy are completely contrived. Mm. They only exist so that the war economy can continue.
It's like the Uber, but for war.
yeah, pretty much.
There's a, you know, there's a quote that I'm fond of using from George Patton, who is not a nice man. Of course, he was to put it lightly, he was not a nice man. But he has a saying, and that is, the only proper way for a soldier to die is by the last bullet in the last battle of the last war. And I feel like that is very much an ideology that gets brought up, you know, by Kojima, because, like, we have to admit, it is a contradiction. Like, war making is not a thing that you can just do, you know, as a free nation, right? You have to have resources. I note that, you know, in Metal Gear Solid 5, a lot of what you do is stealing resources that you can keep your war machine going, right? Because you're not getting people who are making it for you. You're basically kidnapping and converting, quote-unquote, maybe even brainwashing people into doing it. And that is antithetical to the idea that we're going to be an army of free men. No, you're not.
As well as the child soldiers who frequently show up throughout the rest of the Metal Gear series as basically broken people who, from birth, were raised to know nothing but war and often become addicted to war.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I often think of it as war is a symptom of a dysfunctional society, right? But it nevertheless precipitates from a society. The idea that Big Boss can somehow build a nation state that is not a nation state that can continue to do war, you know, in this way is ridiculous, right? Because the nation has to continue. You have to produce the structures. You have to reproduce the structures of the nation state if you want to continue to wage war in the kind of way that you do. You know, Metal Gear Solid is not a game where people run around stabbing each other with you know, rocks and sticks. They fight each other with guns and tanks and things like that, and it's just not sustainable. But, you know, also one other thing that I wanted to mention is that I feel it's really weird, and you have to, as the expert here, you have to really, I feel it's really weird that Kojima has these ideas. You know, he talks about nanomachines, he talks about AI, he talks about fictional walking tank robots, but he never really does a thorough examination as to, you know, maybe a more, a less Soviet style of socialism that could, you know, achieve world peace, you know, like, because I can't imagine the kind of world that, you know, maybe you and I believe in, a libertarian socialist world, more or less. You know, maybe there are states, maybe there aren't, but there aren't any reasons to engage in warfare, you know, large scale, because there are there's cooperation between people. There are no handful of individuals who are in charge of everyone, you know. There's no competition for resources because there aren't really, you know, markets in that way. I don't know. Because it doesn't seem to me that Kojima has really explored that idea as a way of, you know.
No.
Why do you think that is?
He doesn't, oddly enough, he doesn't really seem that interested in discussing the actual ideology at all. He doesn't even really discuss capitalism all that much. I mean, you can tell that he's not super fond of it, but they only really ever talk about, like, black markets and arms race type stuff. They don't talk about any of the effects that capitalism has on an individual. Perhaps on a soldier they do, but not as much, you know, an everyday person.
Yeah, you know,
it's not really something he talks about in detail.
Yeah, you know, it's weird that he spends all this time talking about soldiers, agonizing about soldiers, etc., etc. But, you know, for all of this interest, for all of this stuff, you know, he talks about Che Guevara, he'll talk about imperialism. You know, you mentioned talking that virus, the English language virus, maybe is a commentary on imperialism. But it does sometimes feel very superficial. It does sometimes feel very surface level, you know? Because if you just start peeling back the layers, right, you'll get to a deeper analysis of why nations go to war, what the purpose of soldiers is, in war. I find it weird that for someone who talks so much about soldiers, he doesn't really talk, you know, about why people become soldiers. Like in America, you know, the majority of the armed forces are poor people who join up because the army is a job. And also, you know, you get a lot more benefits. You get healthcare, you get education, you get all the things that America should be providing to its citizens, to its soldiers. And he doesn't really, you know, make this kind of commentary.
No, he doesn't really. It's focused a lot more. When I mentioned that, you know, the theme of family is very important to Metal Gear Solid, that largely is what he is trying to discuss. You know, he's trying to look at the worldview that his father left with him, and he does it through a very kind of nostalgic, idealistic lens.
I think it's almost impossible, you know, to really disentangle that, because it is a very... Kojima was born into an ideological position, I think, of contradictions, where you've got a father who is pro-military, but you've got a country that was devastated by war, you know. And it's difficult it's difficult for a lot of people to just, you know, live their daily lives, but it must be very difficult for someone to also lose his father. You know, I have a feeling that if Kojima's father had lived long enough, I think Kojima would have, you know, come to realize that his father maybe wasn't as idealistically, you know, representative, but because he lost his father so young, maybe that's why he built this idealization of him. Whereas generally speaking, if you live long enough to, you know, see your parents as people, you tend to realize actually they also have flaws. They're also, generally speaking, as flawed as you are. But we are almost running out of time. I do want to cover one last thing before we go, and that is Death Stranding, just a little bit briefly. And the reason why I want to do that is because that is Kojima Unchained. You know, we've mentioned earlier that Kojima has a problematic relationship with Konami. They were forcing him to make games he didn't want to make, and arguably they were destroying his creative process. Metal Gear Survive was a mess. Because the company's relentless desire to pursue profits over actually making a good game ended up, you know, destroying and hollowing out the series. But Death Stranding is a game that Kojima made, and he has very much total control of it in a way, right? It was his game. It was his thing. And it's a very interesting game, but it's also a very weird game. How do you think Death Stranding bodes for maybe the future of Kojima? What do you think? Do you think it's a good sign or a bad sign?
It's a little difficult to tell. He's got a lot more cinematics in it than he did Metal Gear Solid 5, so he's got his chance to put in a lot more movies, and he also falls back to a lot of his bad habits. I mentioned earlier that I feel he's a better game designer than necessarily a storyteller or even a movie maker, and Death Stranding very much represents that, because Death Stranding's gameplay, I think, represents its themes and ideas beautifully. I actually rather like the game of Death Stranding. I get why it's not for everyone, but it's kind of an elucidation on ideas that he had in Metal Gear Solid 2 regarding social media and how it divides us. And this is probably the topic he most went into, the political topic he most examined in both Metal Gear Solid 2 and Death Stranding, and in a very, forward-thinking way enough to be in its own episode.
Yeah, but you know, I look very favorably on Death Stranding because I think it's a very weird game. But I'm mm-hmm. a big fan of weird games. I like ideas that are different and strange. And
same.
Death Stranding is a game about connection. It's a game about people, about mm-hmm. human beings, human society, and it does this primarily by being a mailman who, unironically, is named Sam Porter Bridges. A mailman who's bridging society, who's bridging America. And mm-hmm. it is weird, but at the same time, I get it. Mechanically, a lot of what Death Stranding is about is delivered very perfectly. And, also there's kind of an evolution because there are female characters in the game and they aren't, weirdly sexualized. They're just people. And it also, on the other hand, you still get a lot of Kojima's classic kind of wackiness because you've got characters who are named like Die Hard Man. And also it's full of celebrities. Like Kojima wants to make a movie because you've got like Mads Mikkelsen, you've got what's his name?
Guillermo again? Del Toro.
Yeah, Guillermo del Toro.
You've got I should remember Norman Reedus is the main.
Yeah, Norman Reedus, he's the main character.
Lea Seydoux.
Yeah, this is all the people that Hideo Kojima probably would want to make in a movie, and it's like, dude, do you just want to make a movie? But
yeah, and he's going to. Apparently, his studio is going to make movies. We'll see how that works out. I think he's got issues as a director in that regard, mostly that he's wordy and repetitive.
I think Kojima's the thing that I think saves Kojima as a video game designer from the medium of video games is that. Video games allow you a degree of slack in terms of your storytelling because a lot of it is interactive because of a lot of it depends on you. You can actually make up for a lot of bad storytelling because you are the player who's living the story. Whereas I feel if you just make a movie, you have to actually have very good storytelling because you don't have that crutch, in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, Death Stranding could be its own episode.
definitely.
But we are running out of time here. But I've really enjoyed this conversation. I thought it was very enlightening to look at some of the contradictions of Metal Gear Solid. Obviously, we haven't touched on all of them. It's a massive series. It's a massive undertaking. In the time we have left, why don't you, if you want to shout out any of your projects, any of your social media, please feel free to do that.
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Miskatonic Fox. Admittedly, I don't really use it all that much. I mostly use it to repost Fox pictures and stuff. But I tend to be a fairly friendly person. I don't have tons going on in my life at the moment. I'm just trying to fix things up, and thought this might be a fun thing to do.
Yeah, I'm glad that you did because I thought it was a pretty good episode. I always love learning about things that I'm interested in, and Metal Gear Solid is definitely one of these things.
And if you ever want to do an episode on Death Stranding or even discuss when I bring up that, it would be a good way to do it is if we talked about Metal Gear Solid 2 and Death Stranding. Because like I said, I feel like they're very related and they're both very much about social media.
That I think would definitely be a nice episode. If you guys want to see more of that, please give this video a like or, share it around. Maybe comment your favorite Kojima moment. When you were playing a game and you're like, this is just, that's so Kojima.
I think my favorite in that regard is in Metal Gear Solid 3. There's a boss known as the End who is this really old sniper.
Yes.
And there's a way that you can beat this boss without fighting him. And that's to leave your PlayStation 2 off for 2 weeks, come back, and he will literally die of old age.
That's hilarious. I think my favorite Kojima moment from... It's not really a meme, but it's just Revolver Ocelot just talking about his guns. Every time he does that, it's just so funny to me.
This is the best gun in the world.
Cravings, huh? It gives you no tactical advantage or something like that. It's just so funny. So thank you everyone for listening to this episode. You can check out Miskatonic Fox on Twitter. You can follow Bite Marks on Spotify, on Google Podcasts, basically wherever you get your podcasts. Give this video a subscribe. Check out our Patreon. Our link is in the description. Just a single dollar a month really does help. We hope you enjoyed this episode. Take care and good night, everyone.
Yep, good night, everyone.